KALW.
A lot of the time at homeless shelters and stuff, they're lost.
LGBTQ plus people experiencing homelessness are a vulnerable population within an already vulnerable group.
And it's hard for you to be in that area and you're still trying to navigate your life.
Turn left on Florence Avenue.
A three-part series that looks at the unique challenges they face. Then, as reparations for African Americans inch closer to being a reality, we ask who should get reparations.
I'm going to say that California needs to offer $850,000 to $1 million per year for life for every Black American standing in California.
Voices from around the Bay Area. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. For almost 2 years now, KALW has collaborated with over a dozen other California public radio stations in a regional newsroom called the California Hub. The idea is to expand the reach of stories from those stations that are from or for historically underserved communities. Today, we're bringing you a story from our sister station, KPCC. For as many people that are experiencing homelessness, there are just as many stories for how they got there. And for those in the LGBTQ plus community, their challenges are unique. We explore the issue in a three-part series that begins with one of the factors that leads to young LGBTQ plus people becoming unhoused, family rejection. Here's reporter Ethan Ward.
Tyrone Ramsey likes fashion. He likes listening to hip hop. He identifies as a gay man. He was also kicked out of his grandfather's house 2 weeks before Thanksgiving in 2019 when he was 22.
You know, I don't have nowhere to go. Like, I slept outside. I never thought I would sleep outside.
On this warm Saturday morning, we're in my car headed back to the Florence Firestone neighborhood in South LA where Tyrone used to live with his grandfather, and then on those same streets. Tyrone is originally from Lancaster and says he'd never been to Hollywood, but that's where the Los Angeles LGBT Center is based, so he called them because he knew he wouldn't survive sleeping on the streets.
When I walked in my first time, they asked me, they was like, is this your first time homeless? I was like, yeah, this is my very first time homeless. She was like, don't worry, you're going to get a bed tonight.
Tyrone says it was a miracle since the center only has 40 emergency beds and sometimes people wait weeks to get one. A spokesperson for the center said even before the pandemic, they were on track to exceed the number of young people they provided beds for in 2019. When the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority did its 2020 homeless count, nearly 36% of youth who were unhoused said they identify as LGBTQ.
When you get a bed, there's other people there. There's about, like, you know, 15, 20, if not more, people in one room. And that was my first time ever even being in a shelter and living with a whole bunch of people.
Tyrone says it was difficult to stay focused on his goals when so many people were constantly coming in and out of the shelter, all with unique challenges of their own, most stemming from family trauma or struggles with substance abuse.
A lot of the time at the center, like at homeless shelters and stuff, a lot of these people that go there, they're lost, and it's hard for you to be in that area and to be in that space with all that going on and you're still trying to navigate your life.
Turn left on Florence Avenue, then turn right on Walnut Drive.
As we get closer to his grandfather's house, Tyrone motions out the window.
If you look around where, you know, if you look around where we're at, like, you know, my family didn't really have that much opportunity. My whole family has been destroyed by drugs and by gang violence.
We get out of the car and begin to walk toward his grandfather's house. While we're standing in front, he tells me how his grandfather found out he was gay.
I went to go get in the shower and take a shower, and I left my phone on the bed. So he opened up my door, and all of a sudden, like, he would hear this bing, 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 bing on my phone. He was just looking, and he's seen all these guys with no shirts on and stuff like that. He's like, you got to get out by today.
As we're talking, the craziest thing happens. Tyrone's grandfather comes outside.
Like I said, I'm so shocked. I just can't believe that you just popped up like this.
After some introductions and catching up, I asked Tyrone's grandfather if he regrets kicking his grandson out of the house at such a young age.
It hurts, but then I say to myself, I say, nah, I had issues at the time, but I wasn't worried about him because he's a survivor.
I'm a survivor.
Tryvon says he's made peace with his grandfather because that's what Jesus would want, and he wants to move forward with his life. He says he knew he had to take all of the help he could get from the LGBT center.
Once I hit a certain age bracket, I won't be able to have those resources that I have now, so.
The magic number he's referring to is 25. After that, many LGBTQ people are left to figure things out for themselves. Resources are scarce, which means young people and older people usually get prioritized. This problem was made worse by the pandemic.
Resources definitely shifted as the pandemic hit. There were already such a lack of resources for homeless youth in general, specifically for queer youth experiencing homelessness.
That's Shelley Rosenblatt, a crisis specialist at My Friend's Place, a nonprofit in Hollywood that helps unhoused youth. She wants to see more beds available for queer youth in the city.
I mean, we have so many youth who are interested in shelter. It can, you know, be a scary thing going into emergency shelter. Sometimes it's one big room with a bunch of beds, but the fact is there aren't enough of them.
Tryvon says he feels lucky he now has his own apartment in West Hollywood and hopes to start a career in fashion design.
I don't care who done me wrong. I know I want something better for myself.
Next, in part two of the series, we'll look at how the challenges that unhoused LGBTQ plus people face change when they're above the age of 50. Here's part two.
Lisa Chilton can barely contain herself as we walk up to the door of her new studio apartment in Hollywood.
Please come on in to my little abode. Can I offer you some filtered water or sparkling water?
Lisa should be excited. The 63-year-old moved here in August after couch surfing for 5 years. The place is cute. It came furnished and has a bed, a TV, a comfy armchair, and a walk-in closet. We sit down to chat at her dining room table that seats four.
I had two freak accidents involving my head within a 2-week period. I'm told my brain was moved in two different directions, and that was the last day I worked.
That event would send Lisa into a downward spiral for several years as she dealt with huge medical bills, fighting over a worker's comp claim, and taking care of her grandmother in hospice. She burned through her savings quickly. Then came new owners of the building she had lived in for 20 years.
They started offering cash buyouts. I said no to $20,000. I said no to $40,000. I said no up until they got up to $100,000. And at that point, I was about $40,000 in debt, had no income for well over a year, and was scraping just to eat, let alone.
Lisa took the money and moved to a smaller place, but more medical bills ate up what she had left. She rented a room in a house for $500 a month until the owner said everyone had to go. She was left to rely on the kindness of friends.
4 years and 11 months of going from place to place every few weeks. I have two suitcases and both of them now look like they've been through wars.
Lisa said the constant moving took a toll on her mental health.
It was almost as if I had to put on different Lisa skin for every place I went. And when you are laying your head down on a different surface every couple of weeks, when you're older, it changes your body gait. So every couple weeks, I was in physical pain just because I was adapting to where I was sleeping again.
That all changed when Lisa was offered housing at an apartment building for seniors at the LGBT Center in Hollywood. The program works with people over the age of 50.
I walked into the apartment and the tears just started running, you know, because all I had done is sign the lease, but I had keys and these were mine.
Richard Green, director of the USC Lusk Center for Real Estate, says seniors are the fastest growing unhoused population.
People don't appreciate enough how poor so many of our seniors are, that about a quarter of seniors live on incomes, including their Social Security, of $20,000 a year or less, which means that they can afford rents of $500 a month. And of course, it's very difficult to find anything in Southern California that's remotely at that level.
What is good about affordable housing is that it really limits the amount of money that can be increased with rent.
That's Kira Pollack, Director of Senior Services at the LA LGBT Center.
Generally, the rents can only increase around $25 to $50 at the most a year. I know that that sounds really small, but for our folks that are on a fixed income and their Social Security doesn't change at all, that can be really hard.
Pollock says for the past 3 years, the top request they get is to help find affordable housing. She says rezoning land for affordable housing needs to be a priority.
If we don't deal with the other side of it and develop affordable housing for folks that are not yet homeless, we're going to have even more problems.
Right now, Lisa says she's enjoying settling into her new place. You'll never guess one of the first meals she's been dying to cook.
Every place I've been in the last 10 years, liver wasn't welcome. My first grocery trip, one of the first things I was determined to purchase was liver.
When Lisa's not cooking, she spends a lot of time reflecting.
And I find myself doing what I call the Cheshire Cat. I'm just sitting here by myself grinning. And sometimes I sit here by myself and cry. And it is purely from the joy and the miracle of it.
Lisa says there's nothing about her journey she could have changed, and she's learning to embrace it all. Lisa is bisexual, and a couple of weeks after our chat, I texted her wondering, now that she has housing, if she would start dating again. She replies saying, yes, she's open to whatever at this point.
Our final story looks at how unhoused LGBTQ people who are in an in-between age group struggle to find the resources to support them.
If you're over 24, transgender, or Black, you got nothing coming.
That's Pepper, a Black transgender woman in her 40s who I met at an encampment in Hollywood. She says she's been unhoused since 2018 and goes between living in a shelter or her tent outdoors.
Because if you're over 24, 25, honey, you're done. Okay, you're no longer their worry. They feel that you don't matter to them anymore. They don't have any services for you.
Pepper isn't alone in feeling this way. I spoke with several unhoused people in Hollywood who identify as either gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or queer. They all said they felt alienated from social service providers. For transgender people in particular, the feeling of being left out runs deep.
It breaks my heart. I'm telling you, I was that person years ago.
That's Mariana Marroquin, program manager at the Trans Wellness Center at the LA LGBT Center. She immigrated to the United States over 20 years ago to escape persecution and violence in Guatemala. She's also a trans woman who has faced similar difficulties as Pepper.
I think this is a reality, the way our sisters and brothers feel about organizations. If they're not youth, if they're not HIV positive, or they're not senior yet, we don't have many resources for them.
Finding shelter or interim housing for transgender or non-binary people is also hard. Steve Fichter is director of programming for PATH Metro LA and oversees street outreach.
You know, trans female would be if that's where they want to be, on the female floor and vice versa. That can create some challenges among our, you know, guests who may not be as open or willing to, you know, embrace people where they are in their journey.
Victor says landlords have also proven to be a problem for transgender people looking for affordable housing. Some even have wording in leases about the number of visitors that renters can have in their apartments.
The folks who have experienced or are experiencing homelessness are really subject to such a great deal of the prejudices that they face, the sort of assumptions people make about homelessness.
There are a few spaces for trans or non-binary people to turn to in Los Angeles. Shelley Rosenblatt is a crisis and intake specialist at My Friend's Place, an organization that mostly helps youth who are unhoused.
There are actually no non-gender specific shelters. Some youth that come to us are gender non-conforming, non-binary, and want shelter, but the only shelter options are only male or only female.
A spokesperson for LA City Council President Nori Martinez said in an email that the city recognizes it has a diverse unhoused population and has enacted the Enhanced Comprehensive Homeless Strategy with a focus on vulnerable populations.
I hope that there is a real tangible outcome with it. It is one thing to, you know, to say in a memo that, you know, change is happening, change is coming, but it's a different thing to actually put it in action.
Rosenblatt is right to have reservations. Los Angeles County didn't get its first publicly funded bridge housing shelter for transgender women until 2019. For now, Marroquin at the Trans Wellness Center says she's proud of the work that the city is doing. She's happy to live in California where elected leaders listen to their concerns, but she says trans people need more.
We need jobs. We need resources. We need people that donate to trans-led organizations and making sure that that money goes to the community. We can also volunteer with our time, you know, and learning about the community. We always understaff and underfunded. That's the reality of organizations.
Pepper has been working with a nonprofit to find an apartment, but told me she would probably keep her tent outside just in case she runs into problems with her neighbors. It's a sad reality for many transgender and non-binary people across the region. Mauro Keane says her community is resilient and will continue to be at the forefront of social change.
People make assumptions about who we are, and we are just human beings trying to make it, trying to access employment, go to school, learn something, get a job, and provide for the people that we love.
Covering unhoused communities, I'm Ethan Ward.
Ethan is the Unhoused Communities reporter for KPCC. You can find a link to the whole series at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Back in September 2020, California became the first state in the nation to adopt a law that formed an official task force to explore reparations for African Americans in the state. Reparations for slavery and the historical injustices that followed. Governor Newsom appointed 9 people to the task force. It's made up of scholars and lawyers, thinkers, people who are going to make recommendations to the California legislature about reparations next year. It's a big issue with many things to consider. How would reparations work? Who would get them? Me and my co-host Leela Day explored these questions in our podcast, The Stoop. Here's an excerpt from the episode called 40 Acres and a Question. First, we meet a reparations advocate from Oakland named Cash Gaines.
I'm a 33-year-old breakdancer, but in this moment, I identify as a Black nationalist and a reparationist.
So Cash is a dancer, he's a filmmaker, he's studied ancient civilizations, been to 30 countries, and he believes in reparations. And he has this idea. He's made some calculations.
I'm going to say that California needs to offer $850,000 to $1 million per year for life for every Black American standing in California. It needs to be direct cash payments to individuals tax-free, our inheritance denied, separate from the land, the 40 acres and a Tesla.
Okay, so yeah, we're replacing the mule with a Tesla, but how did he come up with these numbers?
Cash has studied the history of Black disenfranchisement, he says. You know, education, economics, housing, healthcare, incarceration, all of it. And he follows these reparations thought leaders. He figures in the population of Black people in California. He figured in how rich California is and how much it's made from industries that have hurt Black people, like the cannabis industry.
California, which is an economy comparable to not just other states, but to other countries. And if you look at the marijuana taxes that was generated in the state of California, it's $817 million they generated in the last year. So they definitely have the money in California alone to already pay for this justice claim and to fix this so we can get on to being all Americans.
And Leela, many people agree with Cash. And there are efforts by folks who are making these calculations to actually see what people are owed.
So, of course, the state task force is going to ultimately decide on what reparations should look like. You know, is it cash payouts? Is it real estate? Is it student loan forgiveness? Is it all of the above?
Yeah, I don't know. But I wanted to get Leela to this other question that folks are talking about. Not just what reparations are, but who should get them. And when it comes to who should get reparations, there are many people who think people like me shouldn't be eligible for any kind of reparations because My ancestors were not enslaved in the United States.
Again, I just never thought about this, that maybe you would not be eligible.
Hannah, Leela?
Yes?
Natalie. That's Natalie Parrott, our producer. What's up? Is something wrong with our mic placement? Something up with the episode? What's going on?
Everything's fine, Leela. Mic placement is great.
Check, check, check.
Yeah. Yours is great, Hannah. Your mic placement is great. I just wanted to jump in here because I'm listening to you too, and I'm thinking about how this reparations conversation might apply to me and what that could look like. You know, I'm half Jamaican, half Trinidadian, and while my ancestors weren't enslaved in the United States, some of them were brought to the Caribbean and enslaved there. What would that conversation look like for me as a Caribbean American?
This is getting really complex now. You and Natalie could possibly not be eligible for reparations. I mean, we need more information. And I know there's someone who spent a lot of time on this and believes he knows exactly what the criteria for reparations should be.
We propose two standards or criteria for eligibility.
So that's Dr. William Sandy Darity Jr. He's professor of economics at Duke University, and he's a leading reparations scholar. A lot of people follow him. He's someone that Cash and so many others look to in this reparations movement.
Okay, so he's someone who's literally written a book on how reparations should be handled. And Cash is going to explain the two criteria that Dr. Darity lays out in his book.
You have to prove that you have an ancestor who was here since the census of 1850, 1860, or 1870. And those years are important because white folks rushed to write down how many Black folks they owned because they were paid reparations after the Civil War, something called compensated emancipation. All right. So that's the first criterion, is can you trace an ancestor back to the Freedmen's Bureau or the censuses around the time of the end of the Civil War? That would tie you all the way back to slavery's ending in America. Not necessarily that you were here since the founding of America, but at least that your ancestor at one point was owed for the work that they did.
Okay, check. I definitely fit that criteria.
And then the second criteria is what we refer to as an identity standard.
An identity standard. Cash, tell us more.
The other prong is, have you been identifying as Black/African-American on federal documents, so on and so forth, for the last 10 years prior to a reparations claim?
And so, Leela, that means census forms, any official documents where you had to write in your race or check a box that asked about your race.
Hannah, do you mark Black African-American when you're filling out these forms?
I do, but I know a lot of Sudanese people, including, I remember, my parents, who used to check the other box, not the Black African-American box.
Okay, yeah, and for me, I definitely check Black on all my forms, so check, check. But you do too, Hannah?
You have two checks. I just have one. So that means so far, you're the one getting a check. That's an excerpt from the podcast, The Stoop, hosted by me and Leela Day. You can hear more opinions on reparations in the full episode called 40 Acres and a Question on your podcast player. We've also got it up at kelw.org. And before we leave you, let's listen to some new music from a local band. This is San Francisco band Monophonics. They'll be playing this Saturday at the Emerald Cup in Santa Rosa. ¶¶ Today's Cross Currents team includes Dorothy Tang, Johanna Miyaki, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tenz, Shireen Adid, Lisa Morehouse, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.